So the first part will be what I promised last time, namely to tell you a little bit about how to generalize in principle conservation conservative schemes into 3D, into higher dimensions, and to higher spatial dimensions, and in particular the Godunov type scheme, and how to then turn it also into a higher order scheme so that we can get higher order accuracy. So this will be essentially the agenda for the first part of the lecture. And then in a similar spirit as last time, in the second part, we'll hear again from you about the Godunov scheme, so about the last assignment. And so we'll go through some of your solutions, exploring some Riemann problems with the Godunov scheme that you implemented, and also with the Lux-Friedrich scheme that you also looked at, and we can and have a look and try and see how they compare. Okay, so the final part here on extension to 3D, the general problem that we consider here is the following. Now we sum over flux contributions associated with every spatial dimension and so for Euler, as you know, and as you derived quite some time ago, our conserved or vector of conserved variables would be the following. So we would have the density and then one component associated with each velocity component, and then the total energy. So now we have a five-dimensional space here. So rho b, and then we have flux functions associated with every spatial direction given by the following. So rho vi, and then we have the momentum flux and the energy flux, and here J is 1, 2, and 3. And so there are two basic approaches of how to essentially generalize a conservative one-dimensional scheme to a three-dimensional scheme. Only one of which I would like to talk about in more detail today because of the time constraints. I will just give you a very brief idea about the first one, which is dimensional splitting. So in general, there are two basic approaches of how this can be done. So one is what's referred to as dimensional splitting. And this is very similar to the splitting scheme that we introduced for balance laws of how to deal with source terms on the right-hand side. And the second general approach is so-called unsplit finite volume schemes. And this will be the approach that I will go into more detail today. So I'll just briefly advertise the first approach, and you can read up more on this in the notes, and also the associated book chapters and so on that I reference on the reading list. But so just to give you the brief idea essentially of how this goes without going into detail. The idea is, again, as I mentioned, to follow a similar philosophy as in introducing balance law source terms. So essentially what you do is you split the whole evolution step of this three-dimensional problem into three individual subproblems, where you only consider one flux contribution at a given time. So the idea being you start, say, for example, with the x direction, and you update your conserved variables with a flux contribution solely coming from the x1 direction. And you use, you know, a one-dimensional Godunov type scheme, or, you know, any other conservative scheme that you like, and that works for you in 1D. You evolve this for a time step delta t using this 1D code. And so you define the result to be the resulting update to be an intermediate result un plus 1/3, which is how I called it here. And, you know, often this is exactly referred to in this type of type of labeling here. And then you plug in this intermediate state, which we call u bar, I believe, in the case of a balance law. You plug that in again into a one-dimensional evolution scheme, and now you update using the flux contribution from in the x2 direction. I should be pointing here actually. Then you update this intermediate. Oops. You update this intermediate state with the flux contribution from in the x2 direction. Again, you update this with a time step delta t, you get again an intermediate state un plus 2/3. Again, you use that intermediate state, plug it into your 1D evolution scheme, adding essentially now considering the flux contribution in the third spatial direction. And finally, you call that resulting state the final update un plus 1. And so you can essentially get a three-dimensional scheme out of a one-dimensional algorithm. Now, one problem associated with this is with these types of approaches is, as I pointed out in the balance law case, namely that strictly speaking, this splitting scheme again introduces a split error, which is linear. It's of order delta t. There can be, as we also discussed for balance laws, there can be sort of more elaborate schemes where you only update, you know, for half a time step, and you reshuffle some of the updates, the update operators, in a way that you get cancellation of error terms. And so if you do this in a clever way, you can even get higher order splitting schemes. But the splitting method in general just approximates the real problem, namely the unsplit problem of evolving the full set of conservation laws in 3D, only in smooth regions again. So this error analysis and so the convergence to first or higher order in delta t only applies in smooth regions. And so the splitting scheme can fail in at discontinuities. So when things, when smoothness breaks down. And so this is one general problem with these schemes. And there's obviously ways around it. So in practice, one can then use, for example, very dissipative Riemann solvers or so, like HLL, that tends to smoothen out discontinuities so that you actually never really run into this problem, so that you can still have, you know, essentially shocks forming, but they are immediately smoothed out to some extent, so that your solution kind of stays continuous. And so these schemes would only really work with, for example, if you would use a Godunov type scheme, would only work with fairly dissipative Riemann solvers. But obviously the attractive viewpoint is that you don't need to write a full 3D scheme. You can just use a 1D scheme and then essentially just call it in every direction, and so you can just turn a 1D algorithm into a 3D algorithm in a fairly simple way. However, what's more used in practice, at least in sort of computational fluid dynamics, are these unsplit finite volume schemes. And so I wanted to discuss those in a little more detail today. But maybe I should just see if there are any questions so far. Okay, if not, then I'll go on with this. The second part, the second idea. So this would be 8.2.2 in our notes. Unsplit finite volume schemes. And so here, as the name suggests, this is essentially a direct generalization of a 1D conservative scheme to a full 3D scheme with flux, taking flux contributions in all directions into account in a single time step delta t. So we'll consider the following setup. Let's say we're in a higher dimensional space. say we just look at the projection onto a plane of x1 and x2 here. We have a grid cell. Associated with xi here, and say this is x2j. And so here we have the interfaces at j plus 1/2, and here j minus 1/2, I minus 1/2, I plus 1/2. So this is our fluid cell. We may have different grid spacings in different dimensions. That's obviously allowed. This would be delta x1, for example. And now we have flux vectors, flux contributions with each interface associated with each interface. So the physical flux here, this would be, for example, f2, associated with direction x2 at I, and then j minus 1/2. Okay, so that would be the physical intercell flux for this cell. In a similar way here, we have the flux contribution at the other interface at j plus 1/2. Here the three indexes, the three indices being the three spatial dimensions, so assuming that we're in 3D space in general here. And then a similar way here, we have f1. So this is at I plus 1/2 jk. And so here we would have f1 at I minus 1/2 jk. And maybe just to indicate that, we're at a given time step, we're looking here essentially at one spatial slice at a given time step, tn. So let's, let's denote this here by n. Okay. And so then the straightforward, so in this situation, a straightforward definition of a conservative scheme generalizing from 1D to 3D would be just to add the corresponding flux differences for all associated with all spatial directions. Minus I plus 1/2 JK. J minus 1/2 K. J plus 1/2. And then the same thing for the third direction. And so, as you remember, so the first part is just the definition in 1D, right? And then so here we just generalize this by adding the second and third line, the corresponding flux contributions associated with the other degrees of freedom in space that we have now in this higher dimensional setting. And as usual, here UIJK is again the cell average, now a three-dimensional average. And so for most physical variables, this is usually assigned to the center of a cell as before. And so one of the simple schemes you can write down is obviously one of the simple generalizations one can do here is to take the Godunov scheme that you know pretty well by now and write down a 3D sort of generalization of this. So let's try to do this. So, well, it's not the simplest, but one of the most simple schemes, let's say, generalization. Godunov scheme. So we apply fluxes across each cell interface. In the exact same way as we did in 1D. So here, UIJK in case of the Godunov scheme will be this volume average of the cell, where delta V IJK is the volume of a given grid cell. So this will be now a function of x1, x2, x3, and t. Okay, this is all very obvious. And so the numerical fluxes that we now define in this three-dimensional case are just the following. So the flux contribution in x1 direction will take the physical flux associated with the solution to the local Riemann problem associated with this cell interface from ui to ui plus 1 in x direction. So this here being the solution to the local Riemann problem along the cell interface. And then similarly, for the other directions, we'll take the physical flux associated with that direction and compute again the Riemann problem in this direction, and so on. And so we have a similar expression for the third, for x3. Oops. Okay, this is actually not so much faster. Okay. And so, just to write this down explicitly, this function here is the solution to the Riemann problem just taking this one direction into account. And then similarly for the other directions. So I think I don't need to write this down explicitly. And so again, one can, using this, one can again show this is a conservative scheme in 3D. And obviously one can also use, in the same way as in 1D, one can use approximate Riemann solvers here again to simplify the algorithm. I hope everyone can hear me okay again. I just lost my headset, just lost connection with my laptop.
Sounds great to
me. Okay, yeah, sounds good to you. Okay, that's great. Okay, so this is this was very straightforward. Now, of course, the question arises: can we do any better than this? So the Godunov scheme is only a first order scheme, and obviously one has always to deal with finite resolution. And so, given the computational constraints, can we get something that is more accurate at a finite given resolution? And so I wanted to briefly present here as sort of the last point on these Godunov schemes for now, a way of sort of generalizing this to higher order accuracy, which is known as the so-called Musil-Hancock methods.
Daniel?
Yeah?
Before that, can I ask a question on the 3D case?
Yes, sure.
So in the one-dimensional case, the condition we had was that the Riemann problem from the left cell interface and the right cell interface don't meet before your time step takes place. But here, you know, I can imagine if you have these two Riemann problems, the ones from the X and Y direction would instantly hit each other. So does that turn out to be a problem, or does the solver just can get away with it so long as the Riemann problems on the opposite sides don't hit each other?
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's a good point. So what you have to ask on the so what you do here is essentially you pretend that, you know, all the directions are handled completely independently. As long as every direction, as you choose the global time step for all three dimensions in a way that none of the individual Riemann problems neighboring Riemann problems will cross each other, you're fine. So essentially it's really determined by the fastest wave speed in any along any coordinate direction that essentially sets your global time step. But you can treat the Riemann problems completely independently, or at least this is what the algorithm does. So we do one Riemann problem at a time and you ignore the other dimensions. And so you need to make sure that for every single coordinate direction, this sort of CFL-like condition that we discussed in the 1D case is individually satisfied. And then you take sort of the minimum delta T, or say the maximum delta T that is allowed by all three coordinate directions. That's a good point, yeah. Does it make sense?
Yes.
Okay. So how to do better? And this relates essentially to a question that Eric already asked, I think a few lectures ago when we first introduced introduced the Godunov scheme, and I was mentioning that in principle we don't need to. So when I introduced this idea of this RIA algorithm, so this reconstruct evolve average, and so when I was stressing the fact that in principle we can do piecewise polynomial reconstruction instead of just piecewise constant, which is exactly the original Godunov approach. And so the idea to get to higher order accuracy is exactly that, to move away from piecewise constant reconstruction to piecewise polynomial reconstruction. And so it turns out that this being done in a clever way can buy you additional accuracy. And so this goes back to an original idea by Van Leer and Hancock in 1977 already. And since then, many of such higher order reconstruction schemes have been developed over the years. And so if you look into papers in computational fluid dynamics, you'll find lots of names of these higher order methods. You may have heard of PPM and ENO, WENO, whatever methods. So there have been lots of variants being derived and constructed over the years. So these are these so-called Musil-Hancock methods. So if you want to have a look at some of the original papers here, started in 1977. And so there's a whole series of articles here on this when the idea was first being discussed. So this is actually 1979, I think. The other ones are 1977. Anyways, I also have those pointed out in the reading list, and they're certainly worth to take a look at some point. So it's really a modification of Godunov's original idea. Accuracy. And so the central idea is to use, as I said, to use piecewise linear or higher order local reconstruction I'll discuss this again now I think most of the notation here follows the three-dimensional case. Yeah, so let's keep the three-dimensional case for now. But I'll obviously only plot it and try to draw it only in 1D. So essentially the idea is, instead of reconstructing the initial function for the Riemann problem as a piecewise constant function, we now add a linear part. So this is now just the illustration in terms of piecewise linear reconstruction, and then you get the idea of how to generalize this to higher order terms in delta I in the grid spacing. So this is essentially, let me just remark here, this is suitably chosen slope of UIX in a given grid cell. Okay, so the idea is essentially, if I try to draw this here, to have something like the following. So if this is our x direction, we have grid cell xi here, so it's xi plus 1, xi minus 1. And so here we have our cell interfaces. Right, and so before we were just signing a cell average to each cell, and so this resulting function here was a piecewise constant function, and that defined the initial data for our Riemann problems at these cell interfaces here for the Godunov scheme. And now instead what we're doing essentially is to try to approximate the sort of local behavior of the function by using piecewise linear pieces here. Plus 1x. So this would be y of x is 1 of x. Okay, just to be more precise here, so black would be this. Okay, so and using essentially these slopes, this will define now new sort of so-called boundary extrapolated values. So the values of these piecewise polynomial functions at the cell interface is what we call the boundary extrapolated values. So let's call them, for example, ui plus x in this case. And oops, here, let's say this is ui minus x, just to indicate the coordinate direction here. And so now the algorithm works in the following way. So we modify this RIA algorithm of of the Gordonov scheme in the following way. So we reconstruct cell averages independently. In X, Y, and Z. Select appropriate slopes, delta I, J, K, in all the three directions. Obtain these boundary extrapolated values. I call them BEV for now. So those would be just writing this down sort of explicitly. IJK minus X would be UIJK N minus 1/2 delta XI, then UIJK plus X would be plus 1/2 delta I, and so on for the other directions. Similarly, and so on. So once we have those, these new boundary extrapolated values, so this new sort of reconstruction and the corresponding boundary extrapolated values define essentially a new Riemann problem. And so we come to the evolution part. But here there's actually there's a minor sort of technical detail here that we have to do first. Namely, we first actually advance these boundary extrapolated values by 1/2 a time step, 1/2 delta t, using the exact form of the conservation law. And this sounds a little weird. But this is for a good reason. So let me just first write it down. So we take these boundary extrapolated values. So here UIJKL stands for these boundary extrapolated values. So L means minus X, X, minus Y, Y, minus Z, Z. And so we evolve them with 1/2 delta t delta x using the actual physical fluxes of the conservation law. I j k, this would be minus x minus f 1 at u I j k. The other boundary extrapolated value, the interface, and then so we have the other contributions for the other coordinate directions. I'm sorry, so this will be delta y. Then we have f2 u I j k minus y minus f2 u I j k plus y, and then also for the z direction, I j k minus z okay, and so and then only the second step will then actually be the solution of the Riemann problem. And so the important point here is that, this is why I'll write it down first, is that we now actually pretend to have piecewise constant initial data for the Riemann problem. So in principle, if we reconstruct with higher order, so piecewise linear or piecewise, some higher order piecewise polynomials, then, I mean, as you can see here, we essentially lose the original Riemann problem, meaning that we have constant states left and right to the discontinuity. Now here we have discontinuities, but the states are actually not constant left and right to those interfaces. And so this is what is usually referred to as the so-called generalized Riemann problem. And so this can obviously be solved, and one can write down solutions to such a sort of more complicated Riemann problem. But the solution is obviously more expensive and more complicated, and in general, not that easy to do. So this is why essentially one tries to ignore this here, and then just use these boundary extrapolated values and define an effective Riemann problem by just pretending constant states left and right of the discontinuity. Now it turns out that if one just does this and ignores the nature of the generalized Riemann problem, the corresponding fluxes that the scheme would give rise to lead actually to an unstable scheme. So this is something that can be shown. So the conservative scheme that would result from just doing this would not sort of withstand a von Neumann stability analysis. And in order to sort of mitigate those problems, one introduces something that sort of to first order cancels these additional terms that lead to instabilities by doing a evolution step of these boundary extrapolated values using the exact physical fluxes of the conservation law. And so one can show, and these are lengthy calculations that we can't go through here, but one can essentially show that doing this actually cures this problem of potential instabilities. So graphically speaking, what one does is to take these extrapolated values, and then instead of doing the Riemann problem right there at the same time, one first sort of evolves them. And so they might then sort of slightly differ. Say let's say after half a time step evolution with the conservation law, we get this value. And then we take this to be the initial state of sort of a classical Riemann problem. We do the same thing here. So let's say this point moves up here in response to sort of this evolution step in 2A. And now we consider this resulting Riemann problem indicated in blue here in step 2B. And so the magic of this is that the source of instability disappears, and also one can show that the error between using the exact sort of solution, so considering the generalized Riemann problem versus only this sort of approximate standard Riemann problem, also the error introduced by this is actually also canceled to first order. So this half time step evolution has sort of this magic of curing both problems at the same time. And so essentially modulo this half time step evolution that we have now introduced with respect sort of with respect to the original Godunov scheme. So if we forget about this, then essentially the higher order accuracy results from the higher order polynomial reconstruction that we use. So this would be minus x I j k if x is greater than zero, where zero refers to the corresponding cell interfaces to find ui plus one half jk of x over t, which we will then evaluate along a speed zero and plug into the flux expression. And so analogous for y and z. So and then the corresponding intercell fluxes found as in the 1D case. So our numerical fluxes, the result of this. Oops. J plus one half K. Okay, and so once we have found the intercell fluxes, the numerical intercell fluxes, then the third step again is to average over a grid cell so we obtain the solution at u at n plus one by averaging the exact, sorry, so here we called it actually un at x tn plus 1. So this would be, in this notation that we introduced, would be ui jkn of x over t. Okay, and so this is a very basic idea. Now one can show, and so we don't have time for that, one can show that this scheme, meaning the piecewise linear scheme, is now second order accurate. And again, and this is obvious, the numerical fluxes can be found with approximate Riemann solvers as well. And numerical fluxes can be found using approximate Riemann solvers. And as long as these approximate Riemann solvers respect the conservative nature of the solution and also the entropy solution, then the scheme will converge, will be conservative again and converge to the entropy solution. So for example, using the HLL solver or HLLE would be a good choice. So maybe just to write this down explicitly again, what I already mentioned in words, note that we did not have to consider the generalized Riemann problem. Just for reference, which would be the problem with initial data using the actual reconstructed function. This would be AJK of X. Sorry, I need to relabel the indices here better. So these now being functions of X. The boundary extrapolated values are evolved by delta t half, which cancels the error introduced to linear order. And provides stability to the scheme. And so essentially the modulo these details. Essentially, what people often summarize this as is essentially the reconstruction method sort of defines gives rise to high accuracy. And so this is interesting and nice because essentially it allows us to keep the same structure of the algorithm, but just changing the way that we do the reconstruction gives us actually a knob essentially to tune and to make this a higher order scheme. And so this makes it sort of interesting to play with and easy to apply to practical problems. We can just run different problems just using some flags in our code, essentially, where we just replace the reconstruction part with sort of these different reconstruction algorithms, and then we can sort of compare the different solutions and see how the order of accuracy actually affects our results. And it gives us a straightforward way to obtain even higher accuracy. So this is what's been done over the years. Even higher order schemes can be devised using higher order reconstruction methods. So for example, the next straightforward step would be to use piecewise quadratic reconstruction. So which is to take the value at that point, and then we add a linear part, linear term here, delta I one. And then we add a quadratic part here, x minus xi squared minus delta x. So this is one particular form here that is typically used. And so one can show that let me just write this down explicitly. So this delta I one and delta I two are estimates for the first and second derivative. And so one can show that this gives rise to third order accuracy in this case. Okay, and one very famous example of this, which is exactly using a reconstruction along these lines, is the so-called piecewise parabolic method or PPM method that you may have come across in computational papers a lot. So this is famous so-called PPM method, which goes back to and Woodward in 1984. I have, if you want to look up the paper, I have it on the reading list as well, and so on and so forth. So one can, from here on, one can even devise higher order schemes. Up to fifth order is typically used in codes these days. These are the so-called ENO and WENO reconstruction methods you may have heard of. That's sort of one of the standards today, but also PPM is still widely used as a third order accurate scheme. Okay, I have to wrap it up here because of the time constraints, because we also want to hear from you. Are there any questions on this? Any final thoughts or comments?
Yeah, so Daniel, I've got a mm-hmm. question on the method you just described. So in the beginning step one, we have to pick a suitable delta given the value.
Yes.
What exactly does that mean to just pick it suitable?
Yeah, that's a great question. Thanks, Boris. I was trying to avoid going into details here. You have to estimate essentially, as I mentioned down here, you have to estimate these deltas, which represent estimates for the derivative. And so you would, you know, use neighboring points to do that. Now it turns out that you cannot just use arbitrary slopes. Typically you would try to, you know, estimate these derivatives by, you know, you could use some sort of forward differencing approximation or whatnot. You cannot just plug in any value for the slope you may find. It turns out that if you have very steep slopes, for example, then this leads to oscillations in your algorithm. This is why one needs to use so-called slope limiters. Every reconstruction method comes with slope limiters, and they try to essentially keep the so-called total variation of your grid function to a minimum. They try to minimize the discontinuities, essentially, so the discontinuities at the cell interfaces, and try to minimize the steepness of these slopes. And that leads to more stability and to and it avoids some spurious effects like these oscillations that can occur. This is a whole another issue to discuss in principle, and unfortunately we don't have time for that, but this is what I mean by suitably chosen. Means that there have to be some slope limiters in place, and there's a lot of literature on this as well, on how to use slope limiters with a given reconstruction method.
Okay, thanks. And these the boundary values, when you evolve them up and down, for the same cell, the two boundary values both move up and down the same amount. Is that correct?
For the same cell, what do you mean? Like at the same cell interface?
No, not at the same cell. For one cell, the two interfaces, do they move the same amount?
Not necessarily, because the values are different, right? So,
What's different between the two?
So you have a value here, right? And the other one would be up here, right? So it's a different, these are not identical, right? So if you evolve this with the conservation law, it's not clear that they would change the same way.
But in the equation, where exactly does that take place in the fluxes?
So the evolution of this intermediate step is here. Right.
But if I were to plug in L equal to X and L equal to minus X, all this extra mm-hmm. stuff would be the same. So the U hat minus U is the same for all L's, right?
Oh yeah, you're actually right. Yes. Yes. Yeah, I believe you're right. Yes. So, in any case, so you evolve these values with the actual physical fluxes, and then you use the resulting value and define that to be your interface, your state for the Riemann problem.
Okay. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. So just to follow up on that, Daniel. So yeah. I don't think I got everything you said about the slope limiters, but so if we forget about this, is the idea that you're going to estimate the slopes by just taking the name? So if you're looking at the slope for UI, you're going to estimate the derivative using UI minus one and UI plus one. Is that,
the idea? That is correct. Yeah, that's exactly the idea.
Okay. And then on top of this, you put some bounds. If the slope is too big, you limit it in some way.
Exactly, that's exactly the idea. Yeah.
Okay.
And then for higher order reconstruction schemes, where you have like piecewise parabolic or then sort of higher order schemes, then you need to use more points, right? So to estimate the all, because then you have to estimate several derivatives, and so you need sort of more points to make it a well-defined problem. And so this means that going to higher order, your stencil size to actually estimate this. And essentially what you do in the end is you do some sort of higher order polynomial fitting. It means that your stencil size needed to estimate all these different derivatives grows in number. Which means that the method also becomes more sort of more expensive. So there's then also a trade-off that going to arbitrarily high order accuracy doesn't really make too much sense, because then also your computational cost grows. And so usually one does some sort of trade-off, some sort of compromise between the two.
Right. So did you say that people go to fifth order?
Yes, you can. Yeah. That's it. Mm-hmm.
No, but as a matter of, you know, routine, is that so what's typical then?
Yeah, so like fifth order is something like typical. So that comes with this. But like something like third order with PPM, as I mentioned, is also still typical. Anything between third and fifth order is still very common and standard today.
Okay, interesting. Thanks.
Yeah. But then anyways, your accuracy at shocks. So if there are actually global shocks in the solution, then your accuracy there will be reduced to first order. And so these accuracy estimates again only hold in sort of smooth parts or continuous parts of your solution. Okay. Any final questions? Okay. If not, then let's quickly move to you. We have another 50 minutes left, and let's discuss your numerical experiments with the Godunov scheme. Let me just disconnect my iPad here. So, Connor, did you want to go first, maybe?
Sure.
Perfect. So I think we have Connor, and then we have Boris, and we have Guillaume, I think, as our three presenters today.
Yeah, so I sort of figured and confirmed that the sort of thing that I did was incorrect. My understanding of the Godunov method, I guess, was flawed, but based on what we sort of took notes on, the way I thought it worked was, you have your exact solutions that we found in the previous one, and then you would form the conservative flux based on those variables, and you would use this exact solution to sort of move the grid cells along. Kind of like, so like, you know, this is the previous, the first step point, and then you would evaluate this exact flux at, you know, the I minus one point and the I point. This is not how it works, because what you're supposed to do is solve the local Riemann problem. But I think in some sense this works better, I guess. Because you essentially get more or less exact matching of the, at least like the average form of the exact solution. So like there's some numerical jitter at the constant regions, but it more or less matches exactly with what you would expect. But it's not the Godunov method, at least, that I have
right,
done.
Right.
So I don't know.
Yeah, no problem. That's fine. That's fine. Now we can change it and use the actual flux from the Riemann problem.
Is this using the solution to the global Riemann problem to calculate the fluxes and then solve it numerically?
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
That's what I thought it what we were supposed to do, but now of course I sort of understand where my sort of understanding was wrong.
Yeah, no worries. That's fine. That's fine. But your Lux Friedrich scheme, I think, looks really great. So that was correct.
This one, I think I understood a lot better. So you know, you can write down the actual numerical flux. And in this one, another I guess reason why I was really confused at first when I was trying to implement this is I didn't have to specify any boundary conditions, because essentially the boundaries, I just used the exact solution anyway. Mm-hmm. So
right.
I didn't have to specify that. But like here, because this is the sort of exactly a numerical method, I have to make sure that I apply the boundary conditions, which I do here. But in any case, my plots look more or less exact. I mean, there's a little bit of differences with what's shown in Toro's book, because he does the exact same thing with these different problems. But yeah, so there's an incredible amount of smearing. So like before, you could see like at least the discontinuities are somewhat, in some sense, exactly matched. But like in this case, you know, you get tons of smoothing. So there's essentially discontinuities don't even exist. And you can only tell that they're there by a little bit of wiggle. So yeah. Right.
And that's a general, so that's exactly correct. And so that's a general feature of the Lux Friedrich scheme in this case. It has a lot of numerical smearing. And so, you know, lots of discontinuities and some of these nonlinear waves are completely smeared out and you don't actually recognize them anymore.
It also has an interesting feature that's also present in the book's plots, where like it seems to approximate it in groups of two in the data points. So like each data point seems to be exactly the same in groups of two, which is, I think it has to do with the way that, you know, we're using like the ith one twice in each of these, in this flux. I think it has something to do with that.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah.
So why does that happen? The two dots?
Yeah, I speculate, but I have actually no idea. But I at least know it's correct because it matches what the book has. The book shows exactly this like little two data point stepping procedure in their solution also. But I'm not sure exactly why that's the case.
Yeah, it has to do with the centered stencil. To some degree,
because if you look at the actual solution here, right? So you have the flux, the first flux, which is like the I plus one, and then you have the I minus one over here, or vice versa. I'm not sure which one is which when I put it this way, but you see like the ith one is used twice. Like you use the ith one here, and then the ith minus one here. I one here, I plus one here. So like, I don't know, the ith one is used twice I'm not sure if that means anything, but I think it's like,
I'm not sure. So I haven't actually looked into, so since you guys submitted this last night, I haven't had a chance yet to look at exactly how you solved it. But in principle, I'm not entirely sure if this two spacing. So you're saying that this has to be there, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, at least if the book is to be believed, their solution looks exactly has the features, right? Like it's steps by two.
Okay, that's fine. Yeah, it probably is because the stencil is centered, and you're reusing one of the values for the next spatial point.
But yeah,
that's nice.
That, you know, I think it's most evident in the internal energy plot. There's like a ton of smoothing. Like the general shape might be preserved, but I mean it's very far off, I think.
Right, and so that's the essentially the general sort of essentially the general conclusion from using conservative schemes other than a Godunov scheme. That usually there's a lot of smearing of when it comes to discontinuities and things like that. So although these are all conservative schemes, and you know, in the limit of infinite resolution should recover things, at finite resolution usually they perform very poorly. And this is the whole idea essentially behind the Godunov scheme, to try and improve this. Now with the Godunov scheme, and we'll see this in a second, you also still get smearing because it's only a first order scheme. But at finite resolution, the amount of smearing is remarkably less than, for example, with something like the Lux-Friedrich scheme or so.
I guess what you could do is, to get a better accuracy, is you can reduce this CCFL thing that will make it so that the time steps are smaller. I played with that quite a bit, actually, trying to get various things.
Actually, I found out that making the time step smaller led to more smoothing.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so usually these terms of like of numerical, so I don't exactly recall how it works with the Lux-Friedrich scheme, but usually it's for, you know, these hyperbolic problems, the numerical dissipation term, the error term that appears as numerical dissipation, that usually scales with delta t, and so it's not entirely clear that reducing the CFL condition, you would actually gain much. Instead, you can have the opposite effect, depending on the exact behavior of the prefactor of this numerical dissipation term. That's right.
So the Godunov scheme and the Lux-Friedrich schemes are not first order in time, just in first order in space.
Sorry, say again.
Then are those schemes only first order in space and not in time? There, it seems that dependence on the time step is not clear from what you said.
No, so they are both first order in space and in time.
Then shouldn't decreasing the CFL just make them converge at first order?
That's what I assumed.
Yeah. So Boris, what did you find there? Can you show this to us?
I don't have a plot of it. I just remembered taking the CFL number and lowering it. But I think I defined delta t as CFL times delta x for the Lux-Friedrich scheme. Mm-hmm. So it was literally just the ratio of delta t over delta x. And when delta t over delta x was small, there was a lot more smoothing.
Okay.
I guess you know, reducing the time step doesn't actually change the approximation we've made to the flux. So maybe what you need to do is make more spatial cells. I'm not sure.
That would be my guess as well. If you have a higher spatial resolution, then because of the CFL condition, you have a higher time resolution. And together, they would approximate the shocks better.
Right.
So I've had a question at the back of my mind for some time related to this. So actual fluids always have some viscosity, right? So the order approximation isn't to some extent on physical. So what I'm saying is that in physical reality, the shocks will be smeared by physical viscosity. And I guess I'm wondering if you can let numerical viscosity play the role of physical viscosity. Is there a way of tuning things so that you actually get the right amount of smearing for your shocks?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the problem with numerical viscosity is that you don't have it really under control, because you have it under control to some extent, but it depends on your grid setup and your grid spacing and so on. So as you change your resolution, the amount of smearing you get changes, and it changes in a kind of way that you can predict from the equations, at least for some problems where you can explicitly compute these viscosity terms, so these higher order error terms. Another way it would be, obviously, to, if you really want to control it physically, then obviously you would have to go to Navier-Stokes and introduce an explicit viscosity term with a coefficient that you can actually specify and control. But then you're back to Navier-Stokes, essentially.
Right. So I guess that would make things a lot more complicated.
Right.
But everything would be smooth. So do you gain? I mean, I suppose it's a trade-off, right? I mean, you could start with Navier-Stokes, know that you're dealing with smooth solutions, do finite differencing in the usual way, never mind all those fancy, Riemann problem type techniques. But I guess you would pay a big price because you would have to resolve the shocks, basically.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Okay, yeah. Boris, simply because we're running out of time here, maybe if we want to hear from Boris and Guillaume, we need to hurry up a little bit. Boris, are you ready to show your plots? Let's see what you found.
Yeah, so I quickly made a copy and I ran the case so I can show you. But So here's what I have. Same as before, I just solve the Riemann problem at each cell, and then each cell I take the flux and at a speed of zero, and that's the only quantity that's the whole Riemann problem actually comes out with that I need to use. And so for there, I just do that for the grid, solve it as is, and I overplot the line, the special speeds from the Riemann problem, whatever they are. So here we have rarefaction, discontinuity of shock. And if I use my Fortunoff scheme, it really well approximates all of them. The one difference I have from the homework is instead of using the maximum sound speed, I just straight up calculate the speeds of these waves at every point and find the maximum one there. It's a very small difference. But as you can see, it approximates the shocks well. There's still a little bit of smoothing at those edges, but I imagine as you make your step size smaller, it's going to go through them. It's going to make it more sharp. If you use Lux-Friedrich for the same case, it runs much, much faster. And you get all the same smoothing that we saw before. Surprisingly, it still gets all the shocks. And now that I saw what Connor did, yeah, I also see this two double point feature.
Yeah, you also see the double points there, yeah. Yeah,
yeah, but anyways, it approximates them, again, fairly well in all dimensions. For the second problem, same thing, we have the two rarefaction wave solution. So for this one, the pressure, velocity, and density, they all match with what this true solution expects it to
be. That looks all really nice, yeah.
For the internal energy, it doesn't. I had a suspicion why that might be. I just went back to the proof of convergence for the conservation scheme. And in it, all we proved was that the value is U, which are actually not even rho U and P, they're like rho, rho V in the total energy, that they will converge to their truth values. And I'm guessing somehow this special combination of quantities has this convergence drop out, maybe. And that's why this is not converging, but I didn't actually go through the derivation on that. I'm curious to know if that is what's happening.
At least,
yeah, you're right. Sorry, Connor, you want to comment?
Yeah. Like, at least in the book, they talk about how because the internal energy is essentially just the ratio of the pressure and the density, and since both are very small at that exact point in the middle, small numerical errors compound in their ratio, just because, you know, a little bit wrong is going to be very different to the.
Are those numerical errors coming from something like machine precision, or are they coming from the error due to an approximate derivative?
I think it's the, so like you're dividing the pressure, which is already really small in the P star region, and then the density, which is also very small in that P star region. So I guess any sort of error in their ratio, especially like the density itself. So if that's just a little bit off, you're gonna have a really compounding error.
I don't think it's machine precision, because the internal energy does converge eventually to the right solution. Oh, so it should be the approximation of the derivative.
It's strange though. These numbers aren't that close to machine precision. It's something like, you know, one part in 100 or 1,000. It should easily deal with that.
Yes, but they're quite close to zero. So I suppose any deviation from the true value can cause problem. I don't think it's the machine precision that's at fault here.
Yeah, there's some other fault, but as long as delta t and delta x are going to zero, then this should approach the truth curve, I think. Anyways, so for the time, I'm just
yes. So eventually it will converge. So Guillaume is right. So eventually it will converge, but essentially what you're creating here is vacuum. And so any error in approximating these any error associated with the scheme here of finite resolution will sort of blow up the error here, but eventually it should converge.
Yeah, the trouble I have with that is I have to know where the error is coming from, because it's too, we have far too much precision for it to be machine precision. But anyways, moving on. So if you do the same thing for Lagrangians, you get the same smoothed out behavior as before. Mm-hmm. Even the internal energy, it looks like it's approaching the Godunov scheme with the smooth kernel and that matches before. And just right now, quickly, I ran this Godunov scheme for a few cases. So here CFL is 0.4, and you see it's kind of smoothed out from the two solution. If you make the CFL be 0.2, it's even more smoothed out. Make it 0.1, it's even more smoothed out. I'm not entirely sure what's happening here. It might just be a bug in my code, but this is what I was pointing to earlier, where if you make the temporal time step much, much smaller than the spatial time step, then it smooths it out more.
Okay.
Anyways, that's it.
Thanks, Boris. That's great. And finally, maybe Guillaume, you want to also show your plots?
Yeah, maybe I'll just talk about, in the spirit of today's lecture, maybe I'll just talk about convergence of the schemes, because the rest has been pretty well covered.
Okay.
Boris. Yep. Just wondering, so we know they're supposed to be first order convergence. If we look at this scheme, so this is just Godunov, the Godunov results and the points and the exact Riemann-Solver result with the lines. As you increase the resolution, it does visually seem to converge. So I was wondering, if I plot the global error on that, do I get anything? And something went wrong with my plot. The main thing is I tried to plot the global error on this and it didn't work, as in I got a convergence that was lower than what I expected. Instead of order 1, I got order 0.5 or something. I was quite wrong. And so Daniel prodded me in looking into the fact that some regions are quite problematic and they may not converge as fast as you'd expect. And so instead I plotted, so on the right here, I plotted the, this is the difference between the exact result and the Godunov result, the absolute value for the difference. And you can see that, for example, here this region, you see my cursor, right?
Yes, we can. Mm-hmm.
So that region between 0.1 and 0.3, it corresponds to the second part of the rarefaction, here. And there's an error, yes, but as you increase the resolution, it does seem to converge with order 1. Meanwhile, you have some regions, so the contact discontinuity and the shock in particular, that don't seem to move much, certainly don't decrease with order 1 as you increase resolution. So I thought that was a cool effect. I'm not really sure how that plays into the fact that overall the scheme should be order 1. Because truly the global error is not order 1. So yeah, that was my finding. It's more of a question than an answer. But right. Here it is.
Is it the case that the low frequency stuff is converging of order 1, but the high frequency stuff just hasn't gotten to the linear convergence region yet?
Well, that's a good point. I didn't look at frequencies. I don't know.
Yeah, I think Boris is right. So it might be that these sharp features are not in the convergent regime yet, and so one would have to throw more points at it to get it into the convergent regime. So in principle, yeah, one should see first order behavior everywhere.
I see.
But it's known that these Godunov type schemes have problems, for example, with contact discontinuities, and it's something that we see here, right? So around 0.5 here, your spike is the contact discontinuity. And so that's usually hard to catch for a Godunov scheme, because the characteristics are parallel to the contact discontinuity. And so some quantities stay, you know, constant, the K Riemann invariants stay constant across that front, while only some other quantities are discontinuous. And so for the algorithm, it's often difficult to then sort of focus and to sort of resolve where exactly that discontinuity lies. And so this is why also you see often some smoothing, and we can actually see it here as well, quite some smoothing, smearing across these contact discontinuities. And so those would be the features where that enter the convergence regime the latest. So they need sort of most points, so quite a number of points to get into this convergence regime. And so probably this is what's happening here, what you see here.
Okay, yeah, that's cool. Yeah.
And that's really great. I mean, well done, everyone. That's really great. I like your investigation here into the convergence order. That's great.
Daniel, sorry if I know we're running out of time. Can I just ask a question? Is there a way to derive how the convergence depends on the mode?
How it depends on what? On the mode?
On the frequency.
Oh, on the frequency.
Wouldn't you just do a Fourier transform of the solution and of the truth? Compare those?
I mean, I see how you would look at it numerically, but...
I'm not entirely sure if it's really exactly a question of frequency or whether it's a question of the specific type of, you know, discontinuity you're looking at. So yeah, this is something we should probably discuss this offline.
Okay.
Could get into a longer discussion, but I'm happy to. I think it's probably most likely just the fact that we're looking at a contact discontinuity versus a rarefaction wave or a shock, which typically, since the characteristic impinge or expand away from those waves, are easier for a Godunov scheme to pick up and properly resolve. So I'm not entirely sure if it's exactly a problem of frequency, but we can look into this and discuss more. But probably we should wrap it up here, at least for now. I'm happy to stay longer on the call if you want to discuss more. But other than this, I think we have to call this, unfortunately, the end of the course. Thanks everyone for bearing with me and staying here up until the very end. Thanks a lot for all your hard work on the problem sets, and especially also on the practical problems that took quite some time to implement and to run. I hope it was useful for everyone, at least to some extent, and I hope it might help you, might be of use for your current or maybe potential future research. The goal obviously was to provide some basis on which now through also practical exercises, but also some of the going through some of the theoretical concepts, you are now certainly able to read some of the more modern literature on this and understand some of the current algorithms that are essentially just derived of these basic ideas, with, you know, lots more bells and whistles on top. Okay. Thanks everyone.